Great pleasure to be here, Madam Chair. I really enjoyed the discussion this morning, and actually I thought maybe I should skip some of my own prepared presentations, but having thought about it a little bit, I thought what I'd do is I'd cover some of the grounds that you did cover this morning, perhaps some consolidated. And then, as you will see from, you know, what I thought of doing today, we won't be able to get to all of it. So some of it, especially, you know, the information and the discussion on the current state of affairs, as it were, the current state of play of negotiations, I'm not going to talk about. Partly because I was present in the committee meeting when Minister Davies made an overall presentation on South Africa's trade policy and strategy, and I think he did a formidable job. So I won't say anything about that. I do have something to say about that, but perhaps we can do it another time. I thought, Madam Chair, that this, during this...
May I just interrupt you? We are going to be probably finishing that quarter to five or so. I'm sure members will accept that. Even if it's later, that's five, because we're finishing early tomorrow. So let's just let it run.
Okay.
So what is very important to us. It's our second mandate.
Right. So what I thought I'd do, you know, really in this first part of the presentation, I'm going to talk about things that, you know, you won't normally hear in a presentation about trade, but which underpins what people say. You know, it's the theory behind what they're talking about. And I thought I'd just paste some of that for you, some of which you have already talked about already, but I thought, you know, I was happy to follow Nimrod this morning, because mine is really going to be, you'll see the linkages between what he was saying and what I will be saying, but I'm coming in from the trade side, he came at it from the industry side. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can see where some of those linkages are. So the first thing I'll talk a little bit about is some of these basic concepts. This is a discussion that you've had this morning has been going on for a very long time, not just a few decades, but a few hundred years, actually. The same discussion. Mm. And you go back to 300 years ago, an English economist talked about industrial policy 300 years ago. So, you know, the debate has been going on, and I'll talk a little bit about that, you know, let's say, historical debate, which we had this morning, you know, where we are at on that. I'll then talk to you a little bit about, you know, some of the nuts and bolts of international trade, which is now more or less captured in GATT. You know, the whole nuts and bolts, almost everything you need to know or you'll hear about trade is in the GATT. And talk a little bit about that. Where does this come from, this GATT? And what are some of these things, the concepts that you will hear about? You know, well, I'll just try to show you the history and locate those concepts for you. Today we won't drill down into details about each of these concepts. So, for example, the issues that Dimana spoke about today, I'll also, you know, briefly tell you about it. But I won't drill down into it because I'm not an expert on the CBT or the FPS agreement, but I'll tell a little bit about where it comes from and what does it say. And then at some later point, you can, if you wish to, you can go into that sort of very detailed discussion, for example, on anti-dumping. Mm-hmm. If you want to have a detailed discussion on anti-dumping, bring somebody from ITAC, mm-hmm. you know, and spend 2 hours with that person telling you how they do it. But yeah. What I'll do is tell you where does the idea come from and how does it work and what is the WTO discipline on it. So that's where I want to go.
Can I just ask you something? Are you plugged in there, Faisal? Are you actually plugged in with your laptop?
Yes. Yes.
That what overhead there?
Yes.
Because I noticed earlier this morning we had a much fuller house of two extra people, Floyd and Mantash, you know, remember this morning. Mm-hmm. Ms. Mantash will come back again.
and Mr. Shigambu won't come back again today. But I thought, I know when I give a presentation, I find it very difficult when you're talking laterally to people, meaning on the same side. I'm talking possibly to yourself, Jordan and Dean, if I know that, I don't think you're actually plugged in. So in other words, you could just try and move if I clear the plate here for you. Can I ask you to do that, please?
Do you want me to move that one,
yeah? Yes, I was hoping, while you're still with the DA, do come on here, there's at least two places here. I'm just moving back to one side, out of the way to you. I do apologize. Okay, what's the name here?
I know that you are,
because
you didn't make
that. I would love to know it's cheap, you see. All right. You know, Ambassador, I actually think this is a little bit better. Then you can be talking to us here. Mm. Right. So okay. Then go ahead. My apologies for the interruption.
No problem. Thank you very much. So,
Right.
Oh,
good job.
Yeah. I'm used to it. I have 160 countries staring at me. So, you know, the modern theory of trade starts with a guy called David Ricardo, an English economist, trade economist, who came up with this famous idea of comparative advantage. And you know, I'm sure most of you know something about it. But basically what he said, you can capture it in the slide, he said trade is beneficial because why should everyone try to produce everything? You should specialize in what you're good at producing, what you're more efficient at producing. And then trade it with someone else. They can specialize in what they're good at, and they trade it with you, and you can exchange. And in this way, you know, both of you will become your wealth will increase. And here's, of course, the famous example of hops and wine. And he said, well, looking at it from the side, from the English side, you know, the English are better at producing hops, they're more efficient. And the Portuguese are, you know, more efficient at producing wine. And he said, well, if each of you, instead of both of you trying to produce wine and cloth, each of you produce what you could at, and, you know, both would benefit. That was his basic thesis. It is on that sort of basic thesis that many theories were built subsequently. Economists, you know, over the decades, in fact, continued to build on that. I was reading the other day a book by a guy called Eric Reinhardt, who wrote a famous book, and it's about the history of international trade. And he argues that actually, you know, when you really think about Ricardo's theory, it doesn't quite follow common sense logic. It's counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense. Because he says, for example, in 1957, when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, I barely remember that. he said, what happened was the Americans got a shock. You know, they didn't expect the Soviet Union, you know, after the Second World War, to produce the Sputnik, which was, you know, actually the, at that time the leading technology into space. And this gravitated a big discussion in the U.S. And the next thing the U.S. did was they launched their own capacity to follow what the Soviets did. And this is how NASA was created in 1958. And it was to build the capacity of the United States to compete with, you know, the Russians and whoever else. on space technology. So Eric Reinhardt said that if the Americans followed what David Ricardo said, they wouldn't have done that. What they would have done is said, oh, well,
the Soviets seem to be better at space. Let them stick with that. We are seem to be better at producing cotton in the south and, you know, other agricultural products. Let's focus on agriculture. Let them focus on space. Right? But they didn't. They said, we want to be better than them, so let us produce, let us build our capacity to compete with the Russians. Now, although that, you know, the Ricardo theory doesn't seem right, doesn't seem sensible to us, but in fact, you know, when you look at the history of economics in trade, many, many economists, you know, there are some more recent ones like John Templeton, famous well-priced economist, anyone who studied economics 101 at university, you know about Templeton. Then there's the famous trade economist, Jagdish Bhagwati, others like Srinivasan, many others followed this basic thesis of Ricardo and said, well, actually, you know, trade is generally good for countries, and more trade do the better for you, and the more you will improve your efficiency and your economic growth and your welfare. That was the basic thesis, very simplified thesis that started with Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. And in fact, what happened in the 1980s, a very famous paper was written, what became famous or influenced later, by a guy called John Lim, who's an American economist, who was based in the World Bank, and he wrote a paper making essentially the same case as Ricardo. And he, you know, was looking at Latin America, and he said, well, many of these Latin American countries need to follow the basic thesis of Ricardo, which is that they should specialize in areas of their comparative advantage, they should open up their markets, trade more, and in fact, they should allow the market to function, you know, in its natural self, which will be based on Ricardo's theory. You will produce what you're more efficient at producing, and others will produce what they're more efficient at producing, and you will trade with each other. And he says that together with trade liberalization, he made a number of other proposals in the same direction, which is to free the market, privatize, deregulate, open your market to foreign investment, and of course, he said, you will grow and you will increase wealth. But we now know that actually there are many problems with that very simplistic idea that came with Ricardo, but then followed by you know, economists like John Templeton, who still, by the way, whose thesis at the time became famous and was known as the Washington Consensus, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. And that was the paper here in 1990.
A lot of people.
Now, other economists and historians, economic historians, and political economists, they said, no, there's something wrong with not only Ricardo's theory, but, you know, this more sophisticated version of Ricardo's theory, which was, you know, in the Washington Consensus. And they argued that actually this theory was flawed on contextual grounds, on historical grounds, and on ethical grounds. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about why that is the case. But going back to the story of Ricardo, of wine and cloth, the basic critique of Ricardo's theory, again, I think, is made in this book by Eric Reinhardt, in which he says, well, actually, this doesn't make sense. Because when you look at it, you see that what Ricardo is saying is that you must continue to do what your efficient are doing. So if Portugal was good at producing wine, and it continued to produce wine, what would happen is, because wine is, it's an agricultural product, you produce it on a finite piece of land, and, you know, the more resources you put in, the less the output, right? Because you put more and more technology in there, but, you know, it's a finite piece of land, so the return on that investment will diminish, right? So there's diminishing return, but there's increasing costs, right? So the more you put in, the less you get. At first, your output will increase, but then after that, it will start coming up. So that's the law of diminishing returns with wine. But in the case of cloth, you produce cloth in a factory. So the more inputs you put in, the more technology you put in, the more assembly lines you put in, the more production will take place, And in fact, what happens is there's increasing returns because of the volume of production and the multiplier effect. So clearly, as well, you know, it's the logic of basic of comparative advantage condemns those who produce agricultural type products, more basic products, to the law of diminishing returns, and those who produce manufactured products, like cloth, to the law of increasing returns. And he said, therefore, it doesn't make sense because a country producing product like wine will grow poorer, and a country producing cloth, products like cloth, other manufacturers will grow richer. And he said that's the basic critique of the theory of comparative advantage. But of course, more recently, there have been many other economists, you know, who develop more sophisticated critiques of, you know, not only the theory of comparative advantage, but other theories that built on it and argued that, you know, basically increased trade would increase growth and welfare. And some of those critics include people like Stiglitz and others, and they argue that actually the thesis of Ricardo assumes that capital is not mobile. Of course, at the time of writing, which is about 1820, you know, capital was not very mobile. But these days, we know capital is much more mobile. And so if you apply it today, what will happen is capital, of course, will move to where there's lower cost. And if labor costs in Portugal are lower, it will go there, but they will not only go to produce more wine, but they will also move the clothing production to Portugal because labor costs are lower there. And of course, England will be left with nothing to produce because, you know, things will move, which is, of course, not a far-fetched idea. This is exactly what's happening today in countries like the United States. You know, all the low-end production simply has moved offshore into other countries like China and Southeast Asia. So actually, you know, Ricardo's theory doesn't work today. It didn't work, you know, in the past. But Ricardo's theory also made a number of assumptions. You know, he assumed that, you know, there was a surplus market for capital. That means the capital market for information and for risk. And what this meant is that people, you know, all had the knowledge that they needed to produce. He, you know, the models, many of these models that came up subsequently, they also assumed that, you know, the local firms have the capacity to supply, and that workers are mobile, they can move from, you know, if they are unemployed because the labor has moved from, say, cloth production in Portugal to wine production, they have necessary skills to do that. But in fact, what we know is that in many developing countries, this is not the case. Many of these markets are imperfect. Information is not freely available. In fact, there's a cost to it. Credit markets are not, you know, always there. You know, you don't have well-functioning banks, for example, in many developing countries. And in fact, in many developing countries, the supply capacity, the ability to produce, the technology, the infrastructure is simply not there. So the markets do not function as these theories assume when they say that, you know, open your market and the market will, by their own movement towards better efficiency, create the necessary growth and employment. Right. Now, the other kind of critique that has come about Ricardo's theory are from the historians. So economic historians, and I'm very pleased that some of you have read Arjun Chang, because actually I think he's one of the best historians about, you know, trade and industry. He also looks at trade. And he goes back into the history, and Ed Reinhardt is the other guy who's traced the history over the last 500 years. And what they show is that actually you really have to, you know, read Ricardo's ideas very carefully. And you have to think about who he is and where he was from. And actually, I did some checking, and I thought that actually Ricardo was around, you know, about the 1820s. This was the time when Britain was at its, almost at its height, you know. It was one of the industrialized rapidly, and it was one of the most competitive manufacturing nations in the world. It was still a bit protectionist, but it was certainly, it was growing. And they used the free history for that, but it was, and so for Ricardo to say, well, Queen Britain, or we in England, as it was then, we are good at manufacturing, so let us do it, and let those other guys, you know, do wine and other things, you know, but manufacturing, it's us, we will do it. And a congressman at the time, you know, read this, and he said, well, you know, English trade theory is, like most English manufactured goods, it is intended for export, not for consumption at all. So what he was saying was actually, these people, you know, they're saying to us that we must open our market. But actually, when you look at them, they are highly protectionist. And it's true, because at the time, the English were still highly protectionist in agriculture. It was only in 1846 that they began to, you know, open up agriculture, but they were highly protectionist in agriculture. You know, it was a self-serving theory. Now we know from Arjun Chang and others that many other countries, including the United States, and by the way, at the same time, the United States, you know, had just come through the Civil War, and the new U.S. government had a very interesting Treasury Secretary. And this guy, a guy called Alexander Hamilton, he's regarded as the father of infant industry protection. The Treasury Secretary of the United States of America, about writing in about 1795. And just about 10 or 15 years later, another guy called Friedrich List, a German, he came to the United States and he learned from Alexander Hamilton. And they came up with a theory of infant industry protection. They said, well, if we want to industrialize, and of course, they were at that stage less industrialized than the United Kingdom or what had been England. We need to develop policies that will protect our market and allow our small companies to grow, you know, help them to grow. So we need to nurture them a bit before we open them up to international competition. And so this theory of infant industry protection was developed in the United States and Germany. And in the next several decades, this is exactly what they did. Both the United States and Germany, and Dr. Chang writes a bit about that. And so what he says, what Reynard says is actually these guys, the United States, Germany, others after them, they didn't follow Ricardo's idea of comparative advantage. What they did is they defied this, you know, logic of comparative advantage. They defied the logic that said, we'll do what you are efficient in today. They thought like the Americans about the Sputnik. They said, oh, okay, those guys beat us today, but we'll get them tomorrow. So let's build our capacity to do that tomorrow. Now, of course, other writers, which I just refer you to, have written about this in the case of Korea, Taiwan, and others. Guys like Robert Wade, he said, well, what we really need to do is not just follow the market, but try to govern the market, lead the market. And Alice Anderson, she said, well, you know, don't just let the market do its own thing, because what you really need to do is you need to maybe guide the market in such a way that you are able to advance your project to industrialize and to develop the economy. Now, there are other critiques, you know, which I would call, you know, ethical critiques of this idea of comparative advantage. And of course, you know, the one that Reynard talks about, he says, well, if everyone simply did what they are currently good at, you know, and Nuno talks about Ethiopia. Mm. What do you know about Ethiopia? Coffee. They're good at it. And, you know, other basic agricultural products. Mm. And if they follow that logic, why move to flowers? Instead of coffee. And so if you stay with coffee, of course, and you don't process that coffee, I know many countries, you know, you go to Tanzania, you can't even buy coffee from there, which is, you know, processed into a vacuum bag, for example, because they simply didn't develop the technology. So if you followed your basic comparative advantage and produced raw materials and simply sold it, you would remain poor. And so, and you would remain, you know, in the low value added type of production. And in other cases, you know, you have to be careful about trade liberalization. It's not that trade liberalization is necessarily a bad thing or a good thing. It's neither. It just, it really depends on what it is that you want to achieve. And at some point of time in the industry, you want to liberalize. At other points, you don't. Because that's not really the main thing. It's a tool to try to advance industrialization. But if you don't think carefully about it, it can have a negative impact on the poor. And as the Vietnamese case shows, simply liberalizing rice, Vietnamese produce a lot of rice. But of course, they protected more farmers. But if you simply go away with the tariff, you allow a highly mechanized farm in the United States to export subsidized rice, which comes in bulk and cheap, you will of course outcompete the small Vietnamese farmers, and all those farmers will go off employment, and you will increase poverty and inequality in Vietnam. So this can, it can have that effect. It doesn't have to, but it can if it's not closely managed. But most importantly, what is important to know, and bring another concept in from many who have written about this, including Joseph Stiglitz, trade liberalization in almost every country, in short term, also in developed countries, it creates adjustment costs. Because, you know, what will happen is countries which are more efficient in that product will afford to use, and your producers in that product will have to move what, like in the United States, to buy anything in New York cheaper, like footwear, clothing, electronic products, because they import from everywhere in the world and they don't produce that anymore. So what happens is that over the last few decades, their own producers had to go out of work. So if they simply had to leave work, they were not going to, you know, in a few weeks, learn the skills to move into the IT industry or some other industry. They would have to be skilled, you know, trained and all that. And then what happens in the meantime? There would need to be some cushion, some social welfare program. So, you know, you have to think about what happens in that gap, you know, between the time when these workers are out of work and the time when, you know, they are refilled to enter into production in another area, hopefully, where you can compete more successfully. So you have to think about the workers, you have to think about the firms, because the firms themselves will have to learn about, you know, the new competition, new products. And some countries depend on the revenue from the tariff, and they will need to be, some support will need to be provided for that. So basically the theory of comparative advantage, or the theory that emerged from that, which is that trade is necessarily good, and more trade is better, and it increases growth and welfare, as I said, seems to have a number of flaws to it. So what is the way forward? The way forward, as I think I've been saying already, is that especially for developing countries which don't have a highly sophisticated market, and where the credit markets don't work, where the risk is much higher, and where the supply capacity is not very great, these countries need to think about not just short-run increases in their growth and welfare, but they need to take a long view, which is how to increase value added over a long period of time so that we can build our competitiveness with other countries, and then go about doing the hard work of building that capacity, like the United States in the case of the Sputnik. Build NASA, you know, spend a lot of money, put thousands of engineers and scientists, you know, to work, and over the next 10, 20 years, you'll beat the Russians, and you start competing. So trade reform, therefore, needs to be managed gradually and carefully. Not that trade liberalization is bad in itself, but how you sequence it and how you manage it. And trade policy should be tailored to, you know, each country is at a different stage of development. Its particular production is at a different stage of development. And so policies would need to be developed depending on that particular country's state of development and need. So that's my basic summary of the discussion, as I said, which we already have this morning. And I thought what I'd do is just, you know, bring some concepts from the trade area. What I think is that, you know, every idea that I put forward here, as I think I tried to show you, is contested. There are different views on this. You know, you can find a few books by other economists Oh, we'll tell you one story, and another economist will tell you another story. And there are studies, you know, which go in both directions.
Mm.
But for the purposes of this committee, I think what's useful is that these are the context, you know. And as I said to you, you know, if you look at the history of this debate, it goes back at least 300 years.
Yeah.
And we were discussing the same thing. So that's the introduction to the discussion. Maybe we can put the next one on.
I think what we'll do then is, not sure, which that
will be. Too many mics on.
Too many mics on. Just the mic. Yeah.
Right. Is just, you know, in 5 minutes or so, maybe seven, anyone who wants to comment, raise a question, engage, let's just give everyone, shall we say, 1.5 minutes. Okay. Yes, Ms. M. Kongi, Mr. McPherson, Ms. Mantash, in that order.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm again welcome to this presentation. Yes, I also can see the interrelationship between all these presentations and the context therefore. For example, I was interested to ask Nimrod before about there was a question of time. When he spoke about that manufacturing is an engine of economic growth, and that is contested material. You see, and then I link it now with this particular presentation, and I want us to have to go deeper than the relationship between that particular understanding and what is happening. It's unfortunate that you came to this at the end, is my analysis, that you said developing countries need to focus on long-run dynamic competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And then that's an alternative to comparative advantage theory. Because as you were presenting, I wanted to see whether you are going to say this is comparative advantage vis-a-vis competitive advantage. So I'm not aware whether the theory, that the last one that we're talking about, is that what you refer to a competitive advantage? As compared to comparative advantage. So that is what I just wanted to do.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCombie. Mr. McPherson?
Ambassador, I find the presentation always quite interesting because international trade and the ability to grow markets, specifically for countries, are something that I subscribe strongly to. And I'd love you to do it. To look into Pakistan, because Pakistan is a fascinating country for me. It has 5% unemployment. It doubled its exports in 8 years from $5 billion to $10 billion. It's the third largest cotton-based product, whether it's garments or fabric or whatever, yarn. And they're so diversified in their cotton market. And I sort of sometimes, I don't think, one should always just stick to what you're good at, and you should have a diversified market. But they've diversified their market in one particular issue, and they own the entire, value chain. It's fascinating. And Pakistan, I've been there 5 times, my father's been 56 times, and I've traveled South Africa to Pakistan. I'm not sure that that's an honorary citizenship that he wants, but if he grafted, I'm sure he'd take advantage of it. But to my ambassador, they've been very strategic in how they've worked their economy. They're at every international trade show. They're at all the WTO meetings. They market, they sell their country day in and day out for cotton. I'll send you some reading material if you want. If one day you ever got the time to look at how they've developed their economy, it's a great example on trade,
right,
building an entire economy. Thank you.
Now that is interesting, and if we ever get to that part of the world, at least there's someone who understands. Right, Ms. Mantash.
This presentation has been tabled. You know, the mist is going away from my eyes. I'm not an economist.
Yes.
But I'm asking myself some questions. If the ambassador says any country must look into the long run,
yes,
not as a short term, but why did we allow mass smart to come here and destroy jobs? Yes, Because as they were saying, they are coming here to bring cheap products.
Yes.
But people are losing jobs.
Sure.
And our own market was being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked myself, is it more Walmart than Walmart?
Mm-hmm.
Why did we as a country allow that to happen to us?
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean we didn't have this idea of looking in the long term and do long term plans rather than looking at cutting costs for now for our population and forget about the future?
Thank you, Ms. Natasha. I think just perhaps adding to that last point, it all comes down to policy in the end. You know, I think that was raised this morning again, and this is what we said earlier on about the importance of policy space in a country. Where is it? What is our policy vis-a-vis that? What was the policy in Ethiopia, if you like? Of course, they could have carried on with the coffee and maybe done the more focused on processing. They chose flowers. What was that policy? Now, one looks at South Africa. It wasn't so simple that, what was this place, Mark, what do you call this thing again? Massmart, yeah. Walmart. This issue came to the committee, in fact. And there were two or three occasions. I think you were part of the committee at that. Perhaps it was just before you came and then your predecessors were there. But it wasn't a fourth term. And when it first came, it was pointed out, and partly you all agreed on that fact, that this had been banned, Walmart, and several of the cities in the United States where it was now coming from. One of the reasons being the loss of jobs. Well, there were two or three other reasons as well. And there was an element of dismay at the time, and various issues were gone into by both the Minister of Economic Development and the Economic and of course Trade and Industry. And there was some assurance post facto given on this, that in actual fact, there would be as much labour absorption as possible, you know, the core of principle, shall I say, and that it had not been the intention to cut jobs, but their intention to expand and to offer lower priced goods. That was never fully accepted by the committee totally. And one can only think that when it was examined to begin with, the history of that entity, the commercial entity, had not been fully unpacked in the same way as the Wonga history had not been unpacked. So, you know, it's so important to see how people have operated in their countries of origin, shall I put it that way. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there won't be improvements. The agreement actually spelled out a number of issues, and I'm not familiar with everything. But what we will do is to bring it back and have another look at it again. But it did go before the competition board, and it was quite a drawn-out affair. But in the end, we also found that there were multilateral institutions such as the WTO, which also prevented us taking certain action. And we may not be aware of this linkage with the WTO, and we are signatories therein. That's why I said we need a clear understanding of what those advantages are and what the disadvantages are in those multilateral institutions. But this is not, you know, we don't have the time to fully unpack that. Suffice to say, we will bring this back again and try to get a clearer understanding, and maybe you'll be able to join us in that. But what I did want to say, just in terms of the trade liberalisation and all of these different things, I think the great point you made here was, and that's on that page, but trade policy should be tailored to the particular circumstances of the country. Where is your country in its developmental phase? One, what is it that you have in the country? What are the skills you have, etc.? And I don't say that there should be no short-term approach. I do think you need to have three approaches going on. There needs to be that long-term approach, very much so.
And the short to medium shouldn't directly conflict with that long term. However, you can't ignore, say, the fact that you have a very high unemployment rate right now. Say, we don't have to worry about that yet, because medium term we go in here. You've got to take account of it. But in taking account of it, how do you take account of it? I think that's the issue here. But I think that the purpose of this really is to give us, to try and get us all coming from the same platform. If we don't agree, we're not being asked to agree entirely, but do we have these concepts? If some of us here that are economists, that's fine. Others aren't economists. Do they understand the comparative theory? And I think if you could just explain this, the comparative and competitive theory, is there a distinction? Are they in conflict? Or are they parallel? Or are we looking at an alternative? Thanks, Ambassador.
Do you have your hand up? Sorry. No.
Oh.
No, I thought I thought, and then I didn't. Did you have your hand up, Mr. Dirty or Mr. Jordan?
Well, I'm just wondering whether I should get involved in this debate, but I think what I'll say is just that every single economic decision in the world in life is a matter of trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
There are pros and cons to every single question in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nothing that is simply as clear-cut as saying, well, this equals job losses, and therefore it was a bad decision. So I'm no defender of any particular company, and I have no brief for any company, but I will say that it's just not nearly as simple as that. There are lots of things that have to be considered, and the welfare of millions of people who really deserve access to cheaper basic goods is not something that you can just brush aside. It's a very serious consideration. And so these questions are complex, but not...
No.
The time for that debate, not now.
No, we must have it sometime, but as you say, not now. Yes, Ambassador.
No, thank you very much. Well, I agree with the last speaker there. I mean, every decision, every policy decision has to be taken into account, the impact on all different constituencies in the short term, but of course with a view to, you know, the long-term objective, which is to build competitiveness. So the theory of competitive advantage, of course, it has a history, a long history, and others have built on it. What is the alternative? Well, the alternative, as I was saying, you know, in the last slide, was that we have to be much more cautious and careful about how we deal with trade liberalization. And we have to consider each situation on its merits, depending on, you know, which sector it is. What we do in the steel sector may be quite different from what we do in a new industry we want to create in, say, biofuels, in ethanol, or, you know, in a new technology we want to develop. So each sector has its own condition, and you may want to free the market for inputs or intermediate products so that you become more competitive, you reduce your input cost, and you can produce your final good. But then you may want to change that down the line. You know, you have to monitor and adapt. So then, of course, so some of these ideas, you know, the consultants. So the famous one you may all know, Michael Porter. You've all been reading any of these books. Michael Porter was a famous consultant for big business or small business. And he came up with the idea of competitive advantage, which was not to only think about what you're producing now, but what you want to produce, you know, where you can have the higher value added and, you know, higher wages as well, and higher wealth. So competitive advantage is not really a theory as such, but it's just saying, well, don't only focus on today. Think about tomorrow, where you want to be, not where you are now, but where you want to be, and what you need to do to get it. I mean, you know, Pakistan, yes, I mean, many countries, I'm not passing judgment on, you know, any country's trade policy at a particular point in time, because even when you look at the history of, you know, the United States or, you know, the UK, you see over different years it did different things. And Pakistan may, you know, have done some of this, you know, in one sector, but not in another. And I know the textile clothing industry in Pakistan, very dependent on preferences into the EU and the US markets. Very better, you know, Mauritius was. Mauritius diversified, moved out from its dependence, and moved into other things, financial services and other ways. is pretty vulnerable, but it has expanded, there's no doubt about it. As we have lost out to many others like us, you know, we lost in clothing and textiles. So those who have lower costs, like Pakistan, China and others,
yeah,
they get because in fact production moved to countries like them. So I don't know, you know, I don't know whether Pakistan is doing the right or the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not you know, arguing the case one way or another for or against trade liberalization. I'm just saying you have to be careful about how to do it and when you do it and how you do it. Right. So when we look at the history of the gap, where it comes from, actually, then you see how, in fact, almost every country in the world has had a pragmatic view of trade, not a ideological view of trade. And you see, I think this is a very short, very potted issue. I'm sorry, because we don't have time. But actually, you know, what's interesting about the world's trading system, it developed, you know, it doesn't have a very long history. It's just over 100 years ago. We had the creation of what is called the League of Nations around 1919, after the war, the First World War. You know, before the war, in fact, one of the causes of the First World War was trade.
Mm-hmm.
Many countries were protecting, and many countries wanted access to markets. So after the war, countries said, look, you know, let's fix this. Let's talk to each other. And the idea of some kind of multilateral system of governance for the world emerged, including not only on security issues, but including on trade. And this idea germinated at the creation of the League of Nations. It's very interesting for those of you who want to know about our own history, the role of a very interesting South African, Jan Smuts. He was there in 1918 when the League of Nations was created and was one of the drafters. And interestingly, he was also there in 1945 when we created the United Nations in San Francisco. Jan Smuts, he was also there. He was there in 1918, he was there in 1945. But what happened in between? So as we you know, begin to see the end of the Second World War, the United Kingdom and the United States begin to talk. And they say, well, look, you know, the League of Nations didn't quite work very well because it was a loose alliance of countries. It didn't have strong institutions. It didn't have a big secretariat. It had a little secretariat based in Geneva, but not much. And they said, what we need to do is we need to have a, you know, a big, strong, multilateral institution to govern the world, including with the Security Council, but with the General Assembly. But we also need, in the economic field, we need to create institutions in finance, but also in trade. And the idea of an international trade organization was born in the discussion between the U.S. and the United States. And there was a big debate, of course, because the United States comes out, you know, before this, around the First World War, Britain was still the largest power, economic power and political power in the world. But as you go into the Second World War and as you come out of the Second World War, it's the United States. Why? Because as you come out of the Second World War, the United States had massive warehouses full of goods. They were selling. They were producing them and selling.
Mm-hmm.
Including, of course, in arms, because they were supplying, you know, the British others.
Mm-hmm.
But what this did is it made the United States the most powerful manufacturing nation on earth. And the U.S. then said, well, we need a trade system that will create some rules of trade and will allow us to trade freely. You know, it will create some rules, it will open markets so that we can sell our goods internationally. So this was one of the motivations for the creation of an international trade organization. So in the United Nations, one of the bodies of the UN called United Nations Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, a discussion started by about 40, 50 countries. South Africa was also there, the whole South Africa, in this meeting. And they began to draft a charter for this new organization called the International Trade Organization. And in fact, such a charter was written, negotiated between these countries and drafted. It was called the Havana Charter because it was concluded in Havana in 1948. But of course, what happened was that this charter, it didn't live. It was an elaborate charter. set up the the basis for an international trade organization. It didn't lose because in 1950 the United States Congress rejected it, and the whole thing fell apart. But what stayed was one part of that charter which dealt with trade negotiation.
Yeah.
That was called GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. And in fact, the GATT already started work in 1947. And members of the GATT, which included South Africa,
mm-hmm.
began to negotiate how to reduce tariffs on trade and how to create some basic rules for trade. So that was the beginning of the trading system. For the first time in the history of the world, a trading system began to emerge. And what I've put here is just to give a quick sense of, what this GATT is. The GATT, which was focused on trade and trade negotiation, and in the beginning, the GATT was focused on tariffs only. And it the members of the GATT, and you'll see that I've got the number of countries, so the first group, 23 countries, they began to negotiate how to liberalize some of their tariffs. They said, well, I'll do this, let's use this. So there was negotiation. And this was called a round of negotiation, when they all sit together and negotiate, and then when they agree that they implement. And then they start another round of negotiation, and another round. And each of these rounds, I've just put them there, there have been thus far 8 rounds of negotiation since 1947. The 9th round is the one we started in Doha in 2001. It's called the Doha Round of Negotiation, which was, we'll come back to that story, but there were 8 rounds of negotiation, starting with the first one in 1947 and ending with the Uruguay round of negotiations, which ended in 1994. Just as the new democracy mm-hmm. came to being. In fact, I remember Karl Rasmus went to Jerry Keyes to sign the Marrakesh Agreement as the new South Africa came into being. And in fact, a few weeks apart, in April of 1994, the Uruguay round was concluded, which was the last round of negotiation. So let me give you an idea of a long history of negotiation. And I won't go into that, but I'm going to mention some of these rounds, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. many of the rules, because what you asked me to do, Madam Chair, is to talk about
exactly.
the basic rules of trade, mm-hmm. the rules that developed in these negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, the early GATT rounds focused on tariffs. But they also, in 1947, in the first round, they banned quantitative restriction. So a quantitative restriction is not a tariff. It's to say, well, you can export to me, but only a certain volume, say, of clothing or of, cut flowers or whatever. You say, you create a condition, you call it a quota, you say, you can only export to me a certain quota. So quotas were banned in manufactures, but the United States said, in agriculture, we shall retain quotas in 1947, because in agriculture, the developed countries, Europe and the United States, and of course many others, were not very competitive
mm-hmm.
vis-a-vis the developing countries. Countries like, Brazil, and even Australia, even South Africa,
yeah.
were more competitive than many of the European countries in many agricultural products, if you take fruit, for example.
Yeah.
And so they created, they retained protection in agriculture, including quotas, which, by the way, still exist. So we still have quotas
uh-huh.
for some of our products, including yeah. on citrus, by the way, into Europe.
mm-hmm.
There are quotas which still exist and which we are trying to negotiate. We were trying to negotiate in this Doha round. So, but in any case, in those first rounds, the focus was on tariffs. From the Kennedy round, 1964, and the Tokyo round, 1979, we began to talk about non-tariff barriers. Those issues which were not related to the border, the duty of the border, but regulations in the country, domestic regulations, that saying that Imani talked about domestic regulations. So as he said, we in South Africa, like many other countries, we regulate a standard, say for auto components or plugs, electrical plugs. We say, well, you can sell your electrical plug to us, as long as it meets this standard, certified by FABS. If it doesn't meet that standard, we burn it. And similarly, he didn't talk about in agriculture. In agriculture, there the standards that were rated with an agreement called phytosanitary standards, agricultural agreement, which an agricultural system actually, because there are a number of bodies in the world, international bodies, like Jemana talked about today, he talked about TBT, technical barrier.
Just explain what phytosanitary means.
Yes. Phytosanitary is about health standards, health, both human and animal health, and plant health. So it's about protecting your country's, your country, your territory from, say, diseases that may come from other countries that will come with agricultural products. That's why if you go to Australia, you have these dogs, you know, that will sniff your back to see whether there's any agricultural product, because
they
ban.
They do that
because, you know, with these, you know, animal products or plants or whatever that you bring in who may come. But if you import these from another country, you'd want to be sure that you don't also import their diseases. And this is what the Europeans allege now, that South Africa may be exporting diseases to them via our citrus. But we'll come back to that story. But those issues, non-tariff barriers, regulations that countries have in their country to protect themselves, say, safety or health standards, those regulations became the subject of a negotiation in the GATT. They treated discipline. They said, well, you can create a standard, but you know what? Don't create standards that are going to be protecting you, but also protecting, increasing protection. So you use the standard in a way that will not only help you to keep the diseases out, but also keep the product out, because you want to protect your own domestic producers, like the Danish, you know, in Europe. So what you do is then you increase the standards of that product. You make it more complicated so that small countries, as Mana showed you, we have a pretty sophisticated, you know, standard-setting body and accreditation body. Very complex technical standards. Many African countries and others find it very difficult to build that level of sophistication. And therefore, we export citrus. Many other countries produce, but they can't export because they don't meet the standard of the European Union. The standard is too complicated. They don't have the necessary technical infrastructure at home to develop the standard to ensure that the product, before it leaves, it meets that standard. So therefore, the GATT began a negotiation to try to prevent countries from abusing those standards to, you know, basically protect yourself from others, keep the other product out of the market. So that's in those rounds. And then, of course, there are many other agreements that were created in various rounds of the GATT dealing with issues which countries were doing anyway, but just to create some discipline around them. And these were, you know, economic issues. And I'll come back to each of them, like anti-dumping duties to protect countries from, you know, other countries dropping the price and bringing products into your market, or from using standards, that is health and safety, in ways that to protect their markets. And later, what the trading system began to do, it moved beyond non-tariff issues to services. So in the first rounds of GATT, right until the year went on, we only dealt with goods. Goods were like manufactured agricultural goods. Services are intangible. You know, you can't see it, you can't hold it, but it's there. It's something that takes place between a supplier, and that is, and services were not normally regarded as being tradable. It wasn't regarded as something you trade, because it was something that was owned either by governments or it was part of your national infrastructure and you didn't want to trade it, and so there were no rules on it.
services. There was not much trade anyway in services, you know, in previous years. But by the time of the Uruguay round, there was a demand for services to also be under negotiation and for market access in services. And then, of course, intellectual property. So many intellectual property rights go back, you know, the basic concept of a patent to protect something that you think about, you develop a new technology, and you protect it, it goes back a few hundred years, because this was already protected by, you know, city-states like Vienna and Switzerland and others, but this was not regarded as something that should be under negotiation. It was discussed, and agreements were reached, and standards were reached in the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO. But in the Uruguay round, many of these constituencies said, look, we want to negotiate rules on this because we want to make sure that our intellectual property rights are respected world over, not only in our market, but world over, and so we want an agreement on this. And so there was an agreement on it in the Uruguay round. So this gives you a sense of the scope, you know, of the gap from 1947. Now, what the CAS did is it had, when you normally negotiate an agreement, you would say, well, look at this tariff line. So you say, say, clothing. And in clothing, we would talk about, say, T-shirts or, say, a shirt, men's shirt. And for each of these products, say, clothing products, men's shirts, we have one tariff line. And T-shirts, another tariff line. Women's gum, you know, or women's frock or whatever, different tariff line. And so this idea of classifying, you know, giving each one a tariff number, it was a system that was created. They call it the HS system, HS codes. It was just like a, you know, the Dewey Decimal system when you're on the library. You were creating a system to call things, the same thing they did. They created the system. Each tariff had a line, and they would be, you know, and then they would describe things from, a bigger thing like an automobile. So it would be maybe a two-digit description, and then when you go down to parts of automobiles, engine parts, then it would be maybe four-digit, and then if you want to talk about, say, particular, say, spark plugs, it would be an eight-digit item, which would be something more detailed level, but it all has to do with automobile. But then, you know, each thing would be categorized. So these were HS codes. And then the idea was that at the end of each negotiation, when you agree that, okay, everyone will reduce our tariff in, say, clothing by 20%, and then if mine was originally, you know, 100%, now it will be 80%. So then I will now, once I've agreed to reduce it to 80%, I will bind it. That means I will lock it in. That means you can reduce your tariff if you want below 80% to 60% or to 50%, but you can't increase it. It's locked, because once you increase it, it is illegal. You're now violating an international law, an international agreement. And that's because that agreement, every tariff line and what percentage you have bounded at is in a schedule. It's all written down. It used to be a piece of paper, like a, you know, a letter pages for every tariff, what percentage, and that's schedule. And it will say for every tariff line what you've agreed to. So you can't raise the tariff. You can reduce it, of course, if you want to, but you can't raise it, because then you would be in violation of an international agreement. Right. Now, as I said, non-tariff barriers were also regulated under the GATT. Disciplines were created, or rules were created, to prevent countries from using them as protectionist, you know, for protectionist reasons. So what the TBT agreement said, which Guatemala was talking about, that anyone developing a technical standard must obey the national treatment obligation. The national treatment obligation is Article 3. See, you'll see that Article 3, national treatment,
National Treatment says that once a product has entered your market, you should not create rules to actually discriminate against the foreign product and prefer your domestic product. So this thing about buy South Africa, mm-hmm. don't buy from the other guys. You can say that, but you can't create rules which will make it, you know, incentivize your own people to purchase your own products and discriminate against the foreign products. You know, so that's Article 3. It was a cardinal principle of the GATT. We agreed to do that in 1947.
Yeah. Just a couple of questions.
Sure.
At the same time, just with these acronyms,
yes.
I know they are so common to yourself, but
yes.
Not to everyone else. You take PBT,
yes.
and you know, earlier on there was something.
Yes.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask, on national treatments, yeah. we have such provisions in BEE legislation.
Yes.
So how do we, you know, around local content?
Yes.
So how do we achieve that?
Yeah. So I'll come back to another agreement of the, yeah, another agreement that we we're not in agreement of, fortunately, is the government procurement agreement.
Yeah.
Which was agreed, I'll come back to that just now, in the Tokyo round, which was a plurilateral agreement. So plurilateral means, so all the agreements in the GATT were, after everyone agreed, they become multilateral. That means everyone agreed, multilateral. But if only a few of us create an agreement, say of all the members in this room, just a few of us here, we sit down together, we create an agreement between us. It's a plurilateral agreement. I mean, it's an agreement between us. So in government procurement, there is such an agreement. So those countries that wanted to open up some of their market, not everything, but where government is a purchaser of goods, in many countries in the world today, government is a bigger purchaser. Right? And so those countries wanted to open each other's market, selectively, of course. They negotiated an agreement, they called it plurilateral agreement. So, if you are a member of that agreement, then you've subjected your government procurement rule to the GATT. So, when I talk about tariffs negotiation and some of the NTBs, non-tariff barriers and agreements and disciplines, they excluded government procurement. They specifically, explicitly excluded government procurement because at that time, you know, most governments were doing their own thing, and including in the United States, like the post office, you know, the railway lines, all these things were owned by the government anyway. In Japan, the post office is still owned by the government. So therefore, the government procurement, if it's not government procurement, then we are in a gray area there, but. You know, we can discuss that specifically. Right, so the TBT agreement, any technical barriers that you establish has to comply with that Article 3, and any standard you develop has to meet this simple test. It has to be necessary to meet a particular regulatory objective. So if the regulatory objective is, say, safety, like at the plug, you don't want, you know, I don't want my daughter to put her finger there and then, you know, the plug blows up. So that's a safe, that's the objective, protection of children. So then you can say, look, you know, the standard we have developed in South Africa for children safety is this. We want that plug to have these features in it. And you must show that actually that is necessary. Protect the child. So if it does, you get away with it. But it's, you know, it's pretty gray.
Yeah.
Now the SPS, that is gray, the SPS agreement is more gray. Because SPS agreement is about phytosanitary standards. Health, plant health, animal health,
yeah,
human health.
An issue this morning.
Right. So this agreement, because every country has its own
national authority, like in TBG, also in agriculture. We too, in South Africa, we have our own SDS standard. Every product, you know, whether it's maize or poultry or, you know, pig imports, you know, we have a standard, which is European for that, for our own authorities. And then if anyone wants to import to us, they have to meet the standard. If they don't, we don't import. Now, what the agreement says, whether, okay, you can develop your standard, but your standard has to conform with these disciplines. There must be, you know, some scientific basis for that standard. In other words, if you're trying to protect yourself from diseases, you must show how that standard is actually created to protect yourself against those diseases. So there has to be, it has to be an objective test, a scientific objective test to, you know, legitimately protect yourself from a standard, and not simply to prevent other people from importing to you. So basically, you ban everybody's product from the market because they can't understand. Now, having said that, every country then, you know, will have its own risk assessment, you know, and that, as Sivani was saying, like an accreditation authority and an international body. And that is the case in agriculture as well. There are international bodies. Now, where there is no international body, or where there is an international body, but they're not in countries. So there are international bodies in almost every one of these particular areas, but in some cases, only 20 countries or 30 countries, 50 countries. You know, in a world where there's over 200 countries. So, not all the developing countries especially, you know, participate in the creation of the international standards. So, in that case, there's no clear international standards. So in that case, this discipline is even more important. But all the national authority has to do, it has to say, well, we have met the standards. We have conformed. We have a process,
and
investigation.
We
have a scientific basis, da, da, da. We do it. And then all you can say is, yes, but I don't agree. Because we have done the same test. The test you've done on that citrus in your testing laboratory show that, you know, if it has so many black spots, then it could lead to this type of disease. We have done the same test here in our laboratory, and our test shows that actually, you know, the risk is very low, to, you know, so low that it is, you know, hardly possible for disease to spread. And then you have a difference of opinion between the two scientific bodies, which is what we have at the moment with the European Union. And in that case, of course, you can say that, you know, on technical grounds, they have heard, and you can go to the international standard body, which is where we have gone, our farmers, our citrus, so they've gone to the international authority in Rome, and we, in the technical body, to say, well, look, you know, we don't really dispute this, and we are now, we want you to do an arbitration. We want the FAO, where this certain body, FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, based in Rome, and that's where our issue is being discussed, the citrus issue, at the moment. And I don't know what the outcome of that will be. But whatever the outcome of that, it will not be binding, because FAO does not have any legally binding. You know, so even if FAO says, well, actually, European Testing Authority, not quite scientific, and that there was a lot of, say, discussion, it will not be able to enforce it, because it has no enforcement capacity. But the WTO does have enforcement capacity, and so our option then is to take this matter to the WTO, and in the WTO we'll have a panel to discuss it, and to put the experts together to have the court and the FAO and everywhere else. And then we have a dispute about, you know, who is in conformity with the SDS agreement. And then we will have a finding there. And that finding can be enforced. And the Europeans can be forced to change their legislation. Okay. That's the WTO rule on SDS. Right. Now, so as I said, is, you know, there are two main, let's say, fundamental rules in the WTO.
Oh, gas before. So the gas, I'll come back to how the gas changes into the W. But the gas has two basic rules. The first rule was Article 1, which was MSN. Article 1, MSN, the number in the previous slide. And Article 3, national treatment. So MSN says that, you know, countries are allowed to open their markets, but in the GATT, as long as a member of the GATT, you must open your market to country A in the same way as you to country B. So whatever access you give to country A, you must also give to country B. That is what they call most favored nation. You must be as favored as it. Most favored is a critical city word because it doesn't mean what it says. it means that we should not discriminate between two countries. If I open my market to you, I must open my market to you. Non-discrimination. That's Article 1. Article 3 says, once the product comes into my market, I should not do the regulation to then prevent that product from coming in, or make it more difficult for your product to come into my market so that I prefer my own product. That's Article 3, national treatment. So these two are the most important articles in the GATT. Now, having said that, a large number of agreements in the GATT actually deviate from this two principles. A large number. They deviate. They are exceptions to the general rules. So these are the general rules, like Article 1 and Article 3. And then there's a whole lot of rules which say, well, yes, you have to meet those rules, but in this case, you don't have to. And in that case, you don't have to. And I've listed those types of cases. Yeah. Cases where you are trying to help your industry to compete legitimately. Where you're trying to support your economy against, say, unfair or serious threats to the whole economy. Or where you're trying to actually support other members in the trading system. So cases where you're trying to assist the industry is a legitimate case of anti-dumping. Let me go there. Dumping. So in a case where, what is dumping? In a case where somebody sells your product, what they do is they drop the product. The Koreans used to do this a lot in the early stages of the car production. They sell the car at home in Korea at, say, you know, $100, but then they drop the price to $70 when they export into, say, South Africa. Right, so then they make money in the domestic market, they lose money in the foreign market. But what they're doing is they're getting market share. And then they're killing your industry, of course. So that is what they call dumping. What it is actually is called frenzy pricing. So you're trying to reduce the price in order to knock the other guy out. So that is what they call dumping. Now the WTO, the GATT, said, well, because this thing, you know, used to go on, you know, in many countries around the world, all part of global competition. You know, how to knock that guy out, you drop the price and you knock them out. And so in the GATT, they said, oh, look, we have to discipline this. So let's have an agreement called the anti-dumping agreement. Mm-hmm. So we say, look, okay, there is a legitimate, reason for countries to have rules against this sort of dumping. Somebody dumped. But you can't simply say, well, look, somebody has dumped in my market, and I am now going to double the tariff to protect. Actually, you know, the guy may have dropped the price by 20%. Now, instead of, increasing the tariff to 100% more than its current price, you know, you should actually only increase the price, increase the tariff by 20%, because this guy is dumped by 20%. So, you know, the action should be proportionate to the injury. So that was the basic idea. The anti-dumping agreement said, well, look, and there must be some procedure. You know, you can't just arbitrarily say, you know, this guy is dumping in my market. You must have an investigation. You must, you know, the investigation must go through this process. there must be a report. The report must be presented. People can comment on the report, you know, and if they have any problem, they can, and if there's a lack of information or whatever, they can supply the information. And so there's a whole anti-dumping agreement, you know, many pages, which sets out the discipline so that people didn't use legitimate reasons to protect themselves from dumping, but use it in a way which actually, you know, protected the economies rather, you know, it was overreach. So, and then of course the rule says you can impose, once you impose the anti-dumping agreement, tariff, it should be only for 5 years. And then you can extend. But then you can extend every 5 years. So there's supposed to be a 5 year sunset. You know, after 5 years, the sunset finished. But then it became a never-ending sunset. So in fact, there are some anti-dumping duties the United States has imposed, and even others, that have been there for 40 or 50 years. Like on steel products and other products, you know, they keep extending that every time. So actually, you know, the anti-dumping, you know, in many countries, it's become a protection of supply. Because the rules on anti-dumping, although they are rules, they still not very clear. You can't abuse them. Many countries do. They put a lot of discretion about how to go about determining anti-dumping. So that's dumping. Then came another concept in the GATT called countervailing duty. So in the GATT, you know, from 1947, the idea was that countries should only have tariffs. They may use subsidies, but they should not use subsidies that will give them an artificial advantage in foreign markets and actually be used to knock out other countries' production. Because if you subsidize your product, then, you know, especially if you use export subsidies as well, you can knock out, like, I don't know, Western Cape, there was a famous case of canned fruit, and how Greek exports of canned fruit into the Western Cape, you know, undermined our canned fruit producers, you can learn. The famous case of cotton. Western African cotton producers, co-farmers, produce the best cotton in the world. But American cotton producers, in those massive farms they have, massive harvesters, are highly subsidized. And they also have export subsidies. And of course they reduce the world price and they knock out the poor American farmers. So in that case, in manufactured, that cotton is called an agriculture product, but in manufacturing, you would be allowed, if you found that somebody is subsidizing and is knocking you out, you will be allowed to do an investigation. You have a whole procedure followed. And then you can put up a duty against to protect your country from that product. So that is called a countervailing duty. Countervailing duty to defend yourself from other subsidies. In agriculture, we don't do that. We can't do that. Because in agriculture, export subsidies are still legal. They have not been made illegal. We were trying to make it illegal in the Doha round, but they haven't got there yet. So they are still legal. So we can't have a countervailing duty in agriculture. We have not concluded this round and had a round. We wanted to eliminate this export subsidy because only people who use export subsidies or the main countries that use it are the rich countries. And they use it to undermine the agricultural exports of poor countries, including South Africa, by the way. So we also, we are against the export subsidy in agriculture. Okay, so that's countervailing duties. And then there was a third type of, you know, industrial measures that was called safeguards. Safeguards
I think variable ambassador,
sure.
You're forgetting some of these acronyms. I'm sure it's because it's like you've got a surname, JLF or something, and you forget. FCM.
So that's the subsidies and countervailing measures. Subsidies and countervailing measures. So just point out to any of you, because these are all technical issues, and I try to summarize this, but you know, just say what does that mean, because you won't know because it's part of the technical formulations in the in the gap. So then came another idea, another agreement in the gap on safeguards. So in many countries, what they found was that, because for many reasons, maybe another country is more competitive, partly because it's subsidized or because, it is mechanizing, it's got better technology, but the effect of that is more and more of those products are coming. I remember myself in footwear, somewhere between 95, 96, 97, our imports of footwear was rising at a massive rate. Peter Maddox, where I come from, the factories were closing, every month. And they were coming mainly from China. And, there are many reasons why the Chinese were better, partly because they were paying lower wages, they were subsidizing, but also because they were more competitive. But whatever is the reason where we were basically, being swamped with, and our company was looking for. In that case, you are allowed to raise your tariffs on footwear. Not only against China, but across the board. Because those footwear, it was coming by Hong Kong as well, it was coming by other countries. You can just put, you can have general safeguards. You are allowed to do that under the caps in any product where you can show that there was genuine, serious injury to industry.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the case I know, because I come from Peter Maddox, I saw those factors going down. So you can legitimately do that and base an agreement which allows you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was happening in the 1970s and the early 1980s because of Japan. So in the 70s and the 80s, Japan was like China. China, now we all think of China and cheap import in manufacturing. That time it was Japan. So then the Americans said, and the American jobs were gone, because of cheap Japanese food. So the Americans said, look, you can't do this. And if you want to still export to us, you must reduce your exports. And let's just talk about it. And we tell them what the quota is. And the end of that agreement, they created a voluntary export restraint. So a VER is a voluntary export restraint. Where you have decided, because I told you so, to voluntarily restrain yourself, limit your exports to me. The voluntary export restraint, which is what the Americans imposed on the Japanese, but they called it a voluntary export restraint. Remember in the gap, most things don't actually mean what they say. They actually mean opposite of what they say.
Voluntary soldiers volunteering for a headless exhibition.
The voluntary for restraint.
No, you said it yourself.
But if you don't, I'll drop your exports to my life. So voluntary export, this is what happened in there. So this became, it was a safeguard, a U.S. type of safeguard, which of course countries in textiles and clothing, they had to do it. Otherwise, they were blocked from the U.S. market. Right. Now, there are some other ways in which you can still protect your economy legitimately in the gap. One which we use in South Africa, I'm writing a book at the moment on the history of South Africa in the gap. And we were South Africa. Was probably the most intense user of this provision called balance of payments. From 1948 right until 1995, the last one was Keys. Keys in 1995 actually, then stopped the use of balance of payments. But every single year from 1948, South Africa used the balance of payments provision. So if you say, look, look at my trade balance. There's a new data in the last few days, the trade balance, meaning that we are importing more than we are exporting. So the trade balance increases, which means now that, especially on the currency, the land is falling because there's people are looking at this trade balance to say, how are you going to pay for your imports? So they're losing confidence in the currency. And of course, if the rand falls, then of course your ability to purchase from other countries is because other than doesn't have a lot of power. So this was happening to South Africa, by the way. I mean,
have been looking at the documentation, the gap from 1948, because we have a propensity to, as we grow, we import more and more capital goods because we produce mainly primary goods. That's one of the problems being a primary good producer. We import capital goods and they're always more expensive. So there is a provision in the gap. Why did we get away with it? South Africa got away with it. There is a provision in the gap. Article 12 and Article 18. It allows you to do that. So many, many countries have used, by the way, Britain used this, Germany used it in the early period. But then many developing countries did use it, and they still, it's still available. But of course, there are some, you know, some criteria. You have to get a report from the IMF to show that actually you really need this, because you already have a balance of same problem. You know, and then it's discussed in a working group and all of that, and then, of course, you're allowed to use it. There are other measures which you can use. It's not used very much these days, but it was used heavily, you know, until the early 1990s. There are other provisions in the GATT which you can also use legitimately to protect. One is what they call public policy provision. Article 20 of the GATT says that if you need to protect, say for example, environmental purposes, you say, look, biofuels, for example, suddenly discover this technology to develop biofuels, which we want to put into our national grid. And we want to protect this industry for environmental reasons, because we want to move from coal towards cleaner energy. Then we can argue it on environmental grounds, Article 20. So similarly for other issues related to public policy, you are allowed to. Of course, you have to defend it. Somebody takes your dispute, but legally you are allowed to. And then, of course, there's a national security provision. If you just say, look, comes to services, but the United States says, maritime services, we do not allow anyone to transport goods to our harbors between our ports in any ship which doesn't have a U.S. flag on it. The U.S. is banned from doing that. For national security reasons, and of course, it's allowed to do that for national security reasons. Okay, so what I'm showing you is that, you know, whilst there are some basic principles in the GATT, there are many things where you can use policy space, you can increase your tariffs, you can regulate, provided you meet certain disciplines, provided you use it legitimately for a general public policy reason. In the gas. Now there are a few others. There are a few other exceptions. There are a few other ways in which you can deviate from those two principles, right? Article 1, MFN, and Article 3, national treatment. So one of the ways in which you can deviate is you can discriminate. Article 1 says don't discriminate against one person. You can discriminate against others. You can prefer one if you have a custom union. How did this come about? The European Union, they were created in 1957, the Treaty of Rome created the European Union, and then there were, you know, the coal and steel agreements, and then the common agricultural policy, these were precursors to the Union. When it created the customs union, they preferred each other. So those who were in the Union, France and Germany, the Belgians, the first members, they freed the market, they opened the market between them. And then, of course, we were exporting to Germany, so the first casualties of the European integration project, because we were big exporters to Germany first, and our exports to Germany fell, especially of agriculture. Then the British joined, you know, the European Union. We were significantly affected, by the way, by this, because our exports to the EU was, was agricultural products too. So that was a clear case of discrimination against us, but they got away with it because they said it's part of Article 24, which allows you to
regional integration
allows you to discriminate against other countries. Yes, exactly, we do that too. And then of course, another way in which you could discriminate, many developing countries said, you know what,
we are not getting, exports, our exports out because of all the protection in agriculture and textile. So we need, some preferential access. Because the third principle, there's another principle. Another principle in the CAP, which the Americans brought with them, was called reciprocity. Reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans said, any negotiation here means that I'll give you something, you give me something. It's a two-way street. So if I open my mouth, you must also open your mouth. Otherwise, you don't get anything. But developing countries said, look, we can't open our market to you when you are banning, our exports from your market. So agriculture, you couldn't export into the U.S. because first they had quotas, and second they were subsidizing. And then in textiles, they also had quotas. So I can't export what I produce. And so why, and then you say you want reciprocity. So then the idea of, some preferences for these
mm-hmm.
countries came about, 1979. They created a provision called the Enabling Clause.
Mm-hmm.
Under this provision, the GSP was created. So the GSP is the Generalized System of Preferences. So then the United States, the European Union, they created this preferential system. And much later, the United States then, because the Europeans had already created this system of preferences, where they opened the market in some products, they reduced the tariffs a little bit. And the Americans went ahead and they created AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which also tried to do what the Europeans did. So the Americans created AGOA, which is a preferential, preferential access. It allowed some access. But it had to get a waiver for this. Now, a waiver means, where you're actually breaking the rule. The rule says, Article 1 says, don't discriminate. But AGOA is discriminating because actually it allows us, for example, South Africa, better access into the U.S. market, but it doesn't allow Brazil.
Yeah.
So actually Brazil is being, they have a case, they go to the WTO and say, U.S., you are discriminating against, and you're in violation of Article 1, the GATT. But then, of course, we can say, actually we discussed this in the GATT, and we got a waiver for it. And each year, there is a meeting, and there is a discussion, there is an agreement to provide a waiver. So that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now there's two other ways, and I mentioned them quickly, that you can also, get around the principles of GATT. One was called Article 18, which was about instant industry protection. So in 1947, when the GATT was created, Americans didn't want to hear anything about, infant industry protection. Although they had done it themselves, but they didn't want this to be part of the GATT. But, developing countries kept complaining that, they were not, their situation was not being addressed. And so eventually they said, all right, fine. If you want to protect your market to help you industrialize in certain sectors, and provided you come and explain to us how you're doing it, and provided it is temporary, you can. And this is Article 18 of the GATT. It's still available, by the way, Article 18, but it's not very, it's not used very much these days because the requirements are very high. And it is a compensation requirement. So, okay, if you in footwear, if you want protection, then you must open your market to us in other areas. So there must be some compensation.
Right.
And then, of course, there is maybe a final type of way in which you can get around these principles. One is you can renegotiate the tariff. So, by the way, again, very interesting reading the history of South Africa and the GATT. There's a provision, it's called Article 28 of the GATT. When you look at the history of South Africa from 1948, we were the most heavily used provision by South Africa. They were renegotiating every year. They were renegotiating the tariffs. So what you were doing was, you were saying, well, look, these tariffs we opened last year, we reduced it from, say, 60% to 30%. But actually, now we want to raise again. And we'd rather reduce the tariffs in the other areas because they're not producing. And then the next day you change it again. what was going on was that, you know, while we were protecting certain sectors and opening up certain sectors to promote certain industries,
mm-hmm.
We were renegotiating the tariff. Mm-hmm. So Article 28 is still there in the gun, can still be used, by the way.
Sure.
And Ukraine just tried to use it last year, and of course they got into trouble because no one wanted to agree to the renegotiation.
All right, just on that point, Ambassador, also give you a bit of a break for a minute. Let's get some engagement here,
sure.
Because we're then coming on to gas per se. So what we've really done here, we've been to most of it, we've been following, and comments and questions, looking at our time. I know we've got till 5 or so. Let's try and restrict our input to 2 minutes and the outside 3. All right, hands up. I saw you, Mr. Hill-Lewis, followed by. Let's get your hands now. There's rain taken again. I don't know where Mr. Mkongi is. He's just out at the moment. Right. Is that it? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to say a couple of things. It's a brilliant presentation, really, really helpful. It's an excellent introduction to the WTO, which is the most confusing and labyrinthine organization you can ever imagine. And I've just spent a month in America with, and I had 2 WTO ambassadors from LDCs along with me there, and we spent a lot of time with USTR. And all of them spoke very highly of you, Ambassador, so that's a feather in your cap. But a couple of questions. I wonder if you can just repeat or just briefly go back over what you said about the reciprocity in the generalized system of preferences. That was a little bit confusing to me. And then the countervailing measures and safeguards, I wonder whether you can explain that in the context of the current example with frozen chips coming to South Africa, because as I understand, we're using a mixture of both of those measures in that case, both safeguards and countervailing duties. And I just want to understand how those work in tandem, and is it acceptable for us for a country to do both countervailing and safeguards? And then just on our earlier question, I understood what you said about government procurement, but there's many, I mean, BEE legislation, you know, the scorecard requires certain local content to get points, and that applies with 2 businesses doing business with each other, irrespective of government. How do we affect that? How do we get around what you said about that?
Thank you. Mr.
McPherson? Thanks, Ambassador. It's something that I've raised previously around SADC and SAPU and how that fits into the WTO agreements that we have. And I use the example of how, in my opinion, Mauritius and Madagascar are abusing their position in that South African companies have moved offshore their manufacturing units in the textile industry. China has come in there, invested heavily, and all that they're doing is sending goods to us at a discounted rate of 14% or 22% or whatever it is on the specific tariff on that quality of textile. That is a blatant abuse of trade agreements. How do these work in that sort of context when, you know, suppose the trading partners are taking advantage, you know, of the rules that's shown. And how does that fit into the broader context of the WTO agreements? Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much, Ambassador. This, we're all going to really benefit from this, I know, especially as we trade, we're going to make sure this time gets a lot more attention than we have been giving it. But 2 or 3 things. With respect to dumping, and I think both the issues I'm raising, on the one hand, I have agricultural annotations. You will recall the poultry from the chickens from one of our BRICS partners, as a matter of fact, where we raised this on several occasions. And I didn't understand why we found it so difficult to persuade them to stop that sort of practice of this.
And the other issue is to do with the coming back again to subsidies. We are constantly told in these engagements of the WTO that, and here in our own country, we can't subsidize things. We can't subsidize things. And then when you say, well, America's doing it with agriculture, America, you know, so and so, they say, no, they don't call them subsidies. Well, what do they call them if they aren't called subsidies? You know, do we need to just change the term that we have for these things? Why do they get away with it? We know that Europe is practicing this, because I was there one year when the Swiss were supporting the French in wine and something else, I think it was in dairy produce. The other issue is with this, coming back to the phytosanitary issues, you mentioned this yourself, that if we can go to you know, foul and rum, as it were, but those decisions or positions, findings aren't binding. And presumably, they even though they're not binding, they carry some substance if we take them to the WTO. But what I'm looking at is in these phytosanitary issues here, one thinks of the citrus in particular, which cost us so much in terms of labour. What they themselves, Europeans, have got studies done in from their own scientists and laboratories, and they acknowledge them, which prove that it's not a challenge, it's not a problem. But they also have others that say it is, or it does, it can pose a problem. So within their own union, they do have alternative research that has been produced by government agencies as well. So that's what I find most peculiar. And if that has been taken, if you like, to Rome, you've just indicated that's where you're sitting there now. And for the life of me, I really can't accept that they're going to find anything different to what they've learned in South Africa. But notwithstanding that, South Africa has also produced a chemical, or processed a chemical, I think it's onesonite or something, which if you, I suppose, wipe it on or whatever, it prevents what is called sour rot. Now, you see, even before the research and the findings can be completed in Rome, before it's done, and I thought there would be some rule here, the Europeans were intending to take this to their parliament for a vote to outlaw onesonite. It was, I actually had to write several letters to the minister and get him to engage on the matter so that we could persuade the European Parliament not to go ahead and that we'd take this to the WTO. Now, is there no rule? I mean, you agree you're going to go for a finding, okay? So you agree. Then halfway you decide, oh no, leave that alone, I'll do something else. Where is this the approach to implementation of the rules, or respect for the rules? I mean, if they're not going to be respected, what's the purpose of adhering to them? Because I think that was a flagrant disregard for international practice. So you would just comment on that particular one. The other thing was, at one point we said in the fourth term, we don't really agree with plurilateral agreements. At least I think that's where we were when we closed off. And on the other hand, now we seem to be saying, well, no, we don't really agree with it, but, well, seeing as they we can utilize them, do we or don't we agree with them, you know, these plurilateral agreements? And what purpose does it do? Because I thought we wanted to go more for the multilateral approach. So thank you, Ambassador. Mr. Mkongi, I'm not sure if you wanted to come, that's why I got you back. We're just asking a few questions. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mkongi.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. I don't know what is happening with myself, but I mean, I drank a lot of water. So now I must go in and out.
I have to try and think of something scientific,
Something scientific. Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. These are the questions that I wanted to ask. And when I was entering, Chairperson, he was asking exactly what I wanted to ask. Can you waive some of these treaties? South Africa. An agreement that we have, taken you know, decision upon, and what are the risks? If we take, well, there could be agreements that we have reached with countries and then we signed, but they are working in the negative for the Republic of South Africa. Can we waive some of them? And then, if we can, which are of strategic nature that can assist South Africa? Now, I'm asking this because I've raised issues of safeguards. We call it safeguards. Yes, and then what we can do about it. Why we didn't do that on a clothing and textile industry in the Western Cape? And if we're talking about the dumping laws, why would you use some of them from the canned food products of the country? What have been the challenges that we could not? You see? So those are the issues. You have made a comment. You said the dumping is like a predatory pricing. And one of the colloquia, when I was analyzing the import parity pricing, I called it predatory pricing. Now, we came with this concept now for the dumping era. And then I'm not sure whether I used a wrong concept because I said it is a predatory pricing. Okay, thank you very much.
Perhaps just while you're addressing that one, just being raised informally, with respect to the clothing and textiles, the issue that's just been raised, did we not invoke the clause that would have allowed us to, in respect of infant industries, or was it then, of course, no longer regarded as an infant industry as it had been here 30 or 40 years? I don't know, you know, perhaps just a clarification there.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Well, I'm pleased you're all following.
There's
quite a lot to take on at one time. You know? Thank you very much, and thanks to Honourable Lewis for those kind words. Look, you know, I think that where your questions are leading to is what the chairperson was alluding to about you know, these rules the Europeans are making on the hoof. So what the disciplines in the GATT were trying to do, both for the TBD, technical barriers to trade, that's for manufactured products, and EDIES for agriculture, what they were trying to do was that they were trying to discipline them. In other words, they were trying to reduce the discretion, because in the whole procedure of trying to establish a standard, you have a huge margin to you know, either make a standard so that not only to protect my daughter from putting a finger there and getting burnt, but also from making sure that most countries in the world can't produce it. because the standard is too complicated for them. It's only we have some companies that can produce it. So these disciplines were created. But of course, remember, in those areas where the big powers are more competitive, they reduce the discretion. So in TBT, in manufacturing, they're more competitive, they reduce the discretion. In agriculture, where they are not very competitive, they retain the discretion. So the reason why we went in circles, you know, on this surface, is because the discretion, both in the creation, in the rules on SPS, and in the WTO, you know, discipline and the procedures to adjudicate over it, still allow them a wide margin. So as I was saying, in the TBT, the language there was about the necessity test and a science-based, you know, test, something that go through a laboratory, you can say, you know, visit through this assessment. Now, in the agricultural negotiations on SPS, the Europeans brought another concept in. So most countries brought science. Most people understand science. It's about testing something. Scientifically, so objective test. They said, well, in agriculture, science doesn't always apply. What we're going to bring in is another concept called the precautionary principle.
And that means that where the science is not absolutely, you know, clear, then we should rather be cautious and
be conservative.
So we should be allowed to be risk averse. If they think
that
the evidence points in the direction that, you know, this little black hole thing may create, you know, some disease that could be spread, if they, you know, they would rather be cautious. If the science is not clear, they should rather be cautious and take a conservative decision. You know, so that principle still, you know, is there in the green. So
I know you just mentioned that I'm thrown in the green room, and I know what the green room is.
Right.
I'm not sure everyone knows what the green room is.
Right.
I mean, this looks really but this time of the day.
So I think these negotiations that take place, I mean, usually the, you know, in the smaller and smaller rooms, because the membership supposedly is 160 members, but actually the discussions take place in smaller and smaller forums, and it's, you know, at the end, you know, the big powers, which used to be the EU and US, and both of them were highly protectionist in agriculture. Remember, it was the US in 1947, which said that quantitative restrictions should remain in agriculture, not in manufacturing, but in the US. And the US still has a farm policy, you know, in this farm bill that they keep, you know, every 2 years, which is as bad as the Common Agricultural Policy of the European Union. As bad. Because of the, you know, the stuff that is allowed as farmers, and the huge discretion that, you know, they still retain to protect, basically, their legitimate agricultural sectors from competition from other countries. Because right on their doorstep is Mexico and then Brazil. You know, Brazil is one of the most competitive countries in the world in many agricultural sectors, like orange juice, for example.
Mm.
Oranges, which are produced in Florida, they get blocked. those fellows block the Brazilians from bringing either oranges, the full orange, or orange juice, or frozen orange juice, or whatever. Orange juice. There are all sorts of measures to protect it. So the American cotton, you know, many other products, you know, sugar. And because of the lobbies in the U.S. are pretty strong. So both these guys, you know, are retained in the SDS agreement, a measure of freedom, a measure of discretion for national authorities. So of course we can take them on dispute, and we can contest the their conformity with the SDS agreement. But of course, you know, it's not a clear cut case. Because, you know, they do this all the time. To every country in the world, to most countries in the world. They do this to the Americans too, the Europeans. And the Americans have concerns also in citrus, because they also produce in Florida as well, into the EU market. They also need these, you know, SDS type measures, which are clearly designed to protect the European
But are market. They called subsidies?
Now, subsidies, you know, this is what they did, you know, it's also, you know, a famous guy once said, you know, power is the ability to make rules and then change them when you wish. And so what they did with the agriculture, they said, all right, in the first they never wanted to negotiate any rules in agriculture. They said, no, this is a special product, something special about agriculture. It can't be negotiated, it's not that good. And only in the Uruguay realm, but of course developing countries have been fighting to make, you know, agriculture also a part of the GATT. In 1947, Brazil was there, it was part of the negotiation, it wanted. Australia was there in 1947, so South Africa, by the way, we had an interest too in agriculture, and we all said we want agriculture to be part of the negotiation. They said no.
From there, yes.
It was only in the Uruguay round, 1980, that agriculture became part of the negotiation, but when you look at the agreement that resulted, it was pretty vague. The agreements were pretty vague, and just created a framework agreement. It still allowed the United States and Europe and Japan and others to retain not only subsidies, domestic subsidies, what you subsidize them for at home, but also export subsidies, and to retain high tariffs. So, for example, in, you know, Japan has a tariff on rice of over 1,000%. 1,000%. You know, that means it's like a fortress, you know. You can never go in there. It's a complete block. But, you know, in the United States, you can't export peanuts, you know, without meeting a 300% tariff. And then, you know, even in manufacturers, in trucks, the U.S. had a 43% tariff on trucks, by the way. So, you know, in certain areas, they still have high tariffs. They retain them, especially in agriculture. And in the for subsidies, they said, all right, let's create some rules. So they created, an amber box, a blue box, and a green box. Different types. They categorized the subsidies. So they said, all right, amber box, okay, that's a bad subsidy. You know, amber box is a subsidy which you must reduce because it's trade distorting. Because that subsidy is causing prices to fall and other countries to be hurt. Whereas the clear-cut case, like in cotton, that is trade distorting, that's amber. We don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
You can still have it, but you must reduce it. Not eliminate, reduce. That was what was in the Uruguay. Then there's the blue box. The blue box is not as bad as the amber box, but still trade distorting. That's the blue box, second half. Then they created a green box. The green box is, well, you can subsidize because actually this box, the type of subsidies you have here doesn't cause any harm to any others and for good purposes. So for example, a subsidy to for environmental purposes. Say a subsidy to, you know, to reduce the overgrazing.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to reduce overgrazing is leave the land fallow for a year,
mm-hmm.
and subsidize the farmer. You give him money for that year, for whatever profit he would make.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't farm. You give him the money. So he puts the money in the bank. And then he takes the risk out of his business.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he can take more risk and he can export more. So, but they call it the green subsidy. What the United States is talking about now, how to manage these things, they kept moving their money. You know, the programs they had on subsidies, they kept changing the names of those programs and the types of programs they were, so that now when you look at the subsidies, they'll say, well, look, we hardly have any subsidies that are amber. We have a little bit that's blue, but actually most of our subsidies are green, you know, they're harmless. So you do this through clever accounting.
Yeah, I see.
That's exactly what they do.
Oh.
So, you know, ask the question, why, you know, what should we do?
Mm-hmm.
Clever accounting. In fact, once, you know, when we were not, you know, when we were defending the MIGP, I remember some 10, 15 years ago, and I was very new then, and we were still in anti-apartheid sort of period, and I asked the Americans and the Europeans, because Australians raised the matter about MIGP.
I said, look, man,
you know,
things going from what should I do? What should I do?
You
know, these guys are raising problems.
Okay. So they said, well, do us what we did. What did you do? Well, you know, we just heavily worded our programs in such a way that they didn't fall foul of the subsidy agreement. So, and you'll find in the U.S., especially at local level, at state level, a huge number of programs of all sorts, both industrial and government procurement, by the way, government procurement, big time, including Buy American. All over the place, which are clearly not in conformity, but you know they're not written that way. So that's my look. We have not been taken to dispute. Not bad. 20 years into the gap. So we're not doing too badly. Everyone else has. Just about everyone else has. But it's a double. So I think that's an important point. We have talks. You know, I've talked to Australians, for example, myself, on autos for several years. We never got to the panel stage. So it's a question of, you know, how you manage your relationships. You're only in violation of the GATT rule, or the WTO rule now, it's called the WTO since 1995,
when a panel has decided that you are in violation, until then, you are not in violation. So if somebody says to you, hey, you can't do that, you can't put that subsidy because you've been in violation of the GATT, you ask him, who says so? Because actually, he says, no, look at this article, you know, subsidies agreement. But you say, well, the subsidies agreement said that, but actually, if you're only in violation, if somebody says, hey, you're hurting my efforts or my production, and I take you to the panel, and then the panel finds that you are, that's the only time you're in violation. Before then, the jury's out.
All right, look, I just want us to get through the next 15 minutes, your last few slides, please, even though I know you will be coming back again when we do trade. Thank you.
Okay, I know there were some other questions, but we can come back.
At the end, yeah.
All right, so until the Uruguay round, the WTO only focused, or the GATT, as it were, the GATT then, only focused on goods. As I said before, services was not regarded as a tradable. It wasn't regarded as something that you trade, because actually in reality, there was not much services trade, because most of these things were done by governments, like a post office, or railways, or telecommunications even, or even electricity, you know, was done by national power companies, and everyone had national power companies, so they were not. But of course, as you get to the 1980s, things are happening in the world too, right? Privatization is taking place, deregulation is taking place, you know, in these sectors, and of course globalization is, you know, allowing for transportation through, you know, other ways. Transport is getting cheaper, and so services becomes a bigger part of international trade, and of course finance is moving around the world more and more, so financial services are moving, and so some of these industries and sectors and countries that were looking at, why don't we negotiate liberalization of service sectors? Of course, it was a big debate. Developing countries said, no, especially India and Brazil. They said, no, we don't want this to be part of the GATT. This is not a tradable, and this will do harm to our economies. We don't want it. But of course, at the end, by the end of the Uruguay round, they had to, you know, agree. And services became part of the Uruguay round. It was one of the agreements of the Uruguay round, and the agreement that was finally adopted in Marrakesh, which we all supported, including South Africa, became known as the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Services. Now, what it said, it was in fact, the services agreement is very interesting because the services agreement is a lot more friendly to developing countries. Because the services agreement first said that we should liberalize, but we should liberalize slowly. It used the word progressive liberalization.
Mm.
Slowly but continuously, you know, so step by step, not in a massive big bang. And the reason for that was that in many countries, you know, in every service sector, you found that if the particular service, say, especially the big infrastructure services, like telecommunications or electricity generation, if these services were liberalized too quickly and foreign ownership came in, then the national objectives, social objectives of the country would be defeated or would be undermined severely, especially, say, in telecommunications, rural telephony, for example. It's too expensive to put phones and all. For farmers and, you know, farm workers in rural areas.
Yeah.
And it's much more cost efficient, more profitable to do that in urban areas where it's dense. So why would a company go there to rural areas? But government, of course, cross-subsidize, right? Mm-hmm. You know, tax, you cross-subsidize. And
yeah.
So how would you try to ensure that when you liberalize, you still, you know, ensure that service is provided.
Sure.
What you do is you regulate. You have to create a regulatory authority. And the regulatory authority says, all right, we open the sector, but any company that invests here has to meet these objectives. It has to have a certain percentage of its infrastructure in rural areas, for example. I don't know what IATA says in every one of our regulations, but I'm sure they do say so. But this was what was envisaged
But both countries didn't have regulation at that time when the gas was, when the Eurogram negotiations were taking place. So the agreement was formulated in such a way to allow countries to create regulation, so that as they liberalized, they also disciplined the companies so that the companies would provide services to, you know, meet the government's social objectives as well. And so the gas is a bit more friendly than the gas as a whole. The gas also adopted what they call a positive list approach rather than a negative list approach. So positive list means we will agree which sectors we want to liberalize. So if we think, okay, in telecommunications, we need one or two competitors there because we have one, but it's not working very well. So we'll try to liberalize that.
Sure.
But in health services, no, we don't want anyone there because that's a very sensitive sector. And, you know, we have a, mm-hmm. We would prefer to have national companies and operating there. And so we leave that out of the negotiations.
Sure.
You can do that. Right. And so, in the GATT, what is different about the GATT is that the GATT has, in the GATT, normally you talk about cross-border. So goods are moving across borders. But in the GATT, you have three other modes of supply, what they call modes of supply, which is the type of products. So the first is called mode one. That is when a service moves across borders. So telecommunications or move the parcel across borders. That's a service crossing borders. Move two is what they call consumption abroad. So when a tourist comes to South Africa, the tourist comes and the tourist spends money in South Africa. So actually, there's a service that's being provided there by South Africa to the foreign tourists, but the service is not being provided in Germany. Say, if the German tourist is coming, yeah, we are providing the tourist services here in South Africa, not in Germany. So this is consumption abroad. That's tourists getting the consumption of that service abroad. Mostly is where it's quite simple to understand, because there it's like a company, Citibank, or Barclays or something, that creates a branch in South Africa. It has a commercial presence, and then it provides services in South Africa. Mode 4 now was the more interesting service, because this one is about the person is moving. The person is moving. And the person provides the service. So the person can be a consultant on IT.
Oh, right.
The person can be a doctor. The person can be a sports, like Cuban, sports people, they provide services, teaching people basketball, something. It's a service. So these are services which move with the people, or construction, consultants, or engineers, our consulting engineers, by the way, they're some of the best in the world, and they move, say, to the DRC or whatever, and they consult on putting up manufacturing startup or whatever. That is called mobile. It also includes unskilled labor. It also includes unskilled labor. But of course, in practice, it excludes them. In practice. Because in practice, what happens is, when you read the study, it will say, other than, in the gap, they talk about both market access, I wrote that somewhere. In the GATT, they talk about both market access and national limitations. So you can say in MOPO, we allow access to intra-corporate transferees, so companies that want to send their managers here, we allow them to come. But limitation, unskilled work must follow the national immigration laws of the country, visa application. We don't give them any access. So you can have a limitation. So you can say, we open the market, but we have a national limitation. Limitation, government procurement, BEE. Provided you follow the BEE policy, government procurement, we open the market. So you can put that in your schedule.
in your schedule. They are open the market for this, provided you can come and tender for government tender, but you must follow these guidelines. So that is how the guest is written. The guest has 12 core services sets. As you will see, almost every set is potentially, because I said it's positively, you can choose which sectors you want to look like. Business services, communication, financial, transport, almost every health service. Everything is there. And then each one of those, you know, has subsectors.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can have an environment, for example, you have different types of environment, such as marine, for example, or air pollution, or, all sorts of environmental engineering, financial services, you can talk about insurance and equity markets. So these are the different types of services that were negotiated in the Uruguay Lounge through the GATT agreement. And commitments were then offered, which were put in their schedule, with both market access commitments and limitations, national limitations. There was also due regard to domestic regulation. So the GATT said, you can regulate. In fact, they encourage you to regulate, because they knew that, you know, if you open your market in the services sector, you need to have regulations to manage, you know, the foreign service suppliers, and some rules for them. But of course, they wanted to make sure that these rules, again, didn't become too protectionist.
Sure.
So then, in the WTO, we have a committee called the Working Party on Domestic Regulation, that's WPDR, to develop disciplines so that countries didn't give you market access, but then develop rules that made it impossible. So the United States, for example, would say, no, your doctors can come, your lawyers can come, provided they meet our standards, they pass our exam, and they have the same qualifications as our local people.
Mm.
Right. Then it defeats the objective, right? Because then you have to go there and start all over again and do a whole degree, even though you may have had 20 years experience as a doctor. So this says, this committee is looking at how to ensure that whatever standards you have in your country isn't too burdensome, so that you prevent. You say, you know, any doctor can come, provided our qualifications.
No.
Right.
Just one more page.
Yes, yes.
No.
Finally, let me say something. I mean, we talk about this. You know, you'll come across this, and you know, they'll call it new issues. What are the new issues? So far, I've talked about goods, talked about, you know, agriculture, we talked about services, but other issues beyond those were not part of the GATT. Started only with tariffs. As you got to the end of the Uruguay round, people said, look, the world is changing. There are other issues. And there are issues like, competition policy, investment, government procurement. So the government procurement agreement was negotiated, but only with a small group of people, a fully national agreement. But, you know, everyone needs to sign up to the government procurement agreement. And then others even, you know, talked about labor standards and environment. And they wanted, you know, all these issues to be part of the new round. Of course, in the round we did, when we launched the Doha round, we did discuss all these issues. What was eventually agreed was the limited set of issues which are in the Doha round work program, which we will discuss it on another occasion. But out of these new issues, the one that got in was trade facilitation. The other three that were on the table, which some countries wanted, were put aside. Trade facilitation was included in negotiation. Then other issues, you know, didn't come part of the negotiation as such, but became part of what they call working group. A working group in the WTO means something that you start discussing with a view one day to negotiating that. So I was, for example, the chairman of the working group on trade, debt, and finance for two years, actually. Because the big debate in the WTO at that time was on exchange rates and whether we should have discipline on exchange rates.
because the Brazilian people, the Chinese and the Americans, were abusing the exchange rate and creating problems in the market. So they asked me to chair, and I was sharing that, but of course we didn't agree to start negotiations with this, but you know, we are still discussing it. It's part of a research program. Similarly, there's another working group discussing technology issues, including technology transfer. You know, how do we get poorer countries to also benefit from the new technology in the world? Then there's the idea of aid for trade, which did get agreed at one of the ministerial conferences, that you know, we also need to supply capacity to developing countries. Issues like trade and labor standards and trade and environment, of course, are too controversial. They have been discussed. Some countries want them to be negotiated. Other countries refuse to have them negotiated. And of course, there are, you know, there are different types of debates. And sometimes the unions are on one side, sometimes governments are on another. It's quite a complex debate on each issue. you know, the argument on one side is that, look, these are very important issues globally. We need to have labor standards included in WTO so that one country doesn't reduce its labor standards in order to compete unfairly with another country, or one country doesn't increase its environmental standards so high that it makes it impossible for other countries to export anything to its market because they say, no, 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 you can't import that because of environmental standards. Mm. So these are the new issues that are being discussed. Each one is complex, and at some point, one day we will have a chance to talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you go in the world, especially Geneva, but in other places too, this will be discussed. Other MPs that will raise it, especially you can. So these are some of the new things that we should be talking about sometime in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It certainly has been not only succinct, but you've managed to highlight the critical issues. If you would address the last few questions and respond to them as much as you can, and then we'll see what time is left. There are some questions outstanding. Let's go back to the answer those, and then I'll take the round, starting with yourself, Mr. Nkongi, and yourself, Mr. Liyenge. Yes, Ambassador.
Yes. So I'll start with the easier one. You did mention, Chairperson, what are plurilaterals, and I think I explained that.
Yeah.
You know, plurilaterals are subsets of agreement, which everyone doesn't want to participate in, but some do. So in the Tokyo round, 1979, some countries wanted to participate in creating what they call the code.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a code on government procurement. And there was only a few countries, many OECD countries, who participated in those. And the reason they created that sort of a forum is that because they realized, look, we're not going to get everyone to participate. So you know what? Let us do it amongst ourselves, and then we'll eventually persuade the others. So similarly, the anti-dumping agreement was negotiated as a code. The subsidies agreement was negotiated as a code. But when we got to the Uruguay round, they came up with a new idea, which was, well, you know, when we agree at the end to the results of the Uruguay round, we shall adopt all of them as a single undertaking. So here's the new concept, single undertaking, which means you can't just agree to one, you have to agree to everything together. Single undertaking. So many of the codes were then became part of, you know, the multilateral system. But some did not, like government procurements.
Oh.
It still remains. It remains a government a plurilateral agreement.
Mm-hmm.
With at the moment, I think about 50 countries are
mm-hmm.
members. We are not. And so those are plurilaterals. Now, since the Uruguay round and Doha round, we have been negotiating multilaterally.
Mm-hmm.
But the United States, more recently,
they have listened to the responses, please.
So in the more recent period, the U.S. has resuscitated the idea of plurilateral. And they say, well, look, you know, it's too difficult to negotiate all these guys. Let's negotiate amongst ourselves first, like we did in the Tokyo round. And then one day, we will multilateralize it. When they are a bit weak, we'll just focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the plurilaterals are about. So the two big, you know, there are some plurilateral discussions going on in the WTO, like on services. But the other you know, sort of mega regional take a similar form of relation. The one called the TEP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, is a similar type of thing. And then, of course, the TTIP, which is the Transatlantic Agreement, this is the US-EU, the big negotiation between the two of them, is also similar to the plurilateral. It's the two of them negotiating amongst themselves. One day, they hope, whatever they agree between them, they will bring it back to the WTO, and then they will say, all of you guys, you must agree to this. So that's why the plurilateral discussion is very important. On the regional issues, I mean, I know very well, you know, the concern many people have with transshipping, you know, using a country like Mauritius or Madagascar or even Zambia, Malawi or whatever. And then, I mean, you know, like Mozambique used to be for Hyundai, which was bringing in products from somewhere else, just putting in a few, you know, zips or buttons,
yeah.
Or in the case of Hyundai, you know, just putting in the wheels and then bringing it in to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so come to Botswana, but bring it to South Africa. But in a similar way, they use the free trade agreement we have in SADC to bring the goods into the rest of the market, which is mainly the South African market, because the biggest market in SADC is South Africa. Well, what we can do is we can increase the rules of origin. That's what most countries do.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you say, you put in a condition that says that the local content
mm-hmm.
of any product coming into our market,
mm-hmm.
whether it comes from, you know, whichever country in the region, must be X percent for that particular industry. So that, you know, we want to make sure that countries in the region are benefiting from regional integration rather than countries outside the region.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only way you can do it. Everyone else does the same in other regions in the world. On the question of, you know, frozen chips, I'm not too familiar with exactly what we have done there on countervailing and safeguards.
Mm-hmm.
You are, in some cases, you can bring, you know, different types of measures, but in some cases, the agreement specifically says that if you bring a safeguard agreement, you can't bring a countervailing agreement
mm-hmm.
at the same time. Maybe a different time,
mm-hmm.
but not at the same time, because then you'll be double dipping,
mm-hmm.
as it were. So I'm not sure. I don't have the, you know, all the facts on this particular one, but
mm-hmm.
I think we have to be careful not to to double dip. On reciprocity and GSP, well, you know, the Americans, you know, from the earliest days of the GATT, they insisted on this principle of reciprocity. They still are, by the way, obsessed with reciprocity. You can't take anything to the U.S. Congress and say it's for Mala. The U.S. Congress is fundamentally opposed to giving. It will say, what did we get in return? You know, what is the quid pro quo? Reciprocity. It was a key principle they brought to the GATT. That's why it's enshrined. It's in the preamble of the GATT, reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the GSP and any preference that was created subsequent to 1979 was created under the special, you know, exception which they created, and the legislation that was provided for it was the enabling clause. And that said, the Americans agreed to that because actually the reality was that the Europeans were already providing under the Cotonou Agreement, which before that was called the Loughmere Agreement. And in fact, even at the, you know, the formation of the GATT, the British simply brought all their preferences that they had with the colonies into the GATT. It was a big fight. The Americans said, no, you can't do this. And the British said, no, we have to. And so the preferences the British had with the, you know, with Canada, with Australia, New Zealand,
mm-hmm.
even with South Africa, by the way, and some other small countries, which are part of the Commonwealth,
mm.
they insisted that they wanted to retain them. The Americans said no, because this gave them special access to those markets. So in the end, actually, the British won, because the British were so stubborn on it that they gave them some sort of, you know, special exemption. So these preferences were there, although the reciprocity principle was there, but, you know, there was still this exception. And then, of course, the Europeans kept expanding the preferences to their colonies. And, well, then it wasn't called colonies, it was called Commonwealth
of countries. But then, of course, because of agricultural protection and all that, the Europeans extended this preferences to a wider and wider set of countries, because as they expanded the EU, they were more friends with different countries. And the Americans by this stage are also beginning to do this for the Caribbean countries and for some Latin American countries. They were giving preferences too. So they said, well, look, you know, let's create a legislation that will allow this. So they created the enabling clause, mm-hmm. which provided cover for the GSP. But of course, the GSP, you know, was both trade and politics, because the GSP always had conditionalities. It said, okay, we'll give you the preference, but, you know, you must, meet these standards of human rights. And, but they were busy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were cigarettes. Okay, I think we have covered most of it.
All right, just a last few questions. Let's take three short ones. Right, Mr. Mkongi, Mr. Dr. Lumiange, and one up to the Mr. Hilders.
Thank you, Mr. President. Maybe some of the things that I'm going to read, they will need another discussion sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the presentation was going, I didn't know that the ambassador is going to touch on this matter, but there were matters of concern. One is the role of the International Labour Organization in all these equations.
Yeah.
Because I still remember I went to an ILO conference long time ago, and they were playing politics on the question of eight typical forms of labour. And they referred those things into tripartite agreements in those particular countries. That is why we have a crisis of labour brokers in South Africa today. It is a long thing that was negotiated in the labour organization, and then it was referred to tripartite. Mm-hmm. So that's the issue is one. The second one is the issue, which is very important. You spoke that, I'm not sure you said accounting. What it represents, I was asking myself, what is the influence and impact of international finance into international trade agreements? You know, because I could see that there is that influence. So I just wanted to raise those things. But if they need another presentation or discussion, I will propose that it happens in the future. Thank you very much.
Yes, Dr.
Lengi.
Thank you, Chairperson. This presentation, Chairperson, really, it's like a lecture, not just a workshop for a day, because it is too broad and very much enlightening. We can easily locate ourselves in South Africa where we are, and the type of decisions that were taken around the economic growth and sustainability of the country as a whole. But what I would want to check, Prof, is it part of this free trade mechanism where the people who are coming from outside of this country, they will render services and collect money? There's no stage where you will pump those people in the bus. You will find them from 3 o'clock on daily basis. They are queuing on the ATMs, depositing this money into where they come from. Some of them are keeping it in hard cash. Is that not robbing our country in relation to taxes there?
On the revenue.
Because our revenue is highly affected with this, because even those who seem to be fronting owners of garages with these people from outside, you will see them with 5-6 cars, but there is no bank account where you see that the money that has been collected has actually gone through this process.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask about your impression of the future of the Doha round and the multilateral trading system, because mm-hmm. we are seeing an increasing reliance and turn towards the TTIP and TPP, and really, mm-hmm. you know, in my interactions with USTR, it's almost like they've forgotten about the Doha round. Their attention is 100% on TTIP and TPP and to the inclusion of WTO in time. And of course, one can have a debate. In fact, there's almost no debate. You can tell them about the skewed design of WTO agreements and how that's fundamentally unfair to developing countries. But they've got an alternative. They can just go ahead and
negotiate elsewhere. And the only one that the only people that lose are basically Africa, countries like us and countries poorer than us. So, but it's your impression as a returning ambassador on how we fix the government's go and get it moving again, because, you know, I was with you at Bali last year, we were very hopeful. After that deal, it didn't fall apart last time, again. And I think we were all sad to see that fall apart. So that's the first one. Second thing is just a quick technical question on the ECIC. I would interpret that every country has something sort of like an export bank, but it could easily be argued that that is something like a indirect export subsidy. So how do we allow for something like the ECIC WTO law?
Right. If you would,
Ambassador Pavel, just address those views. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, no, thank you very much. Well, clearly some of these we will have to do them, have to discuss them another time to, you know, because they clearly involve the last question. I just made a presentation at the University of Johannesburg on this question about the Doron and where it is now and the way forward. And perhaps, you know, on another occasion we could go into that discussion at length. But I do think that you know, there is a turning point now. There's a big turning point in the in negotiations. I don't think the Doron is going to survive, and mainly because the United States has decided against it because it's not in its interest. And the U.S. is embarked on a global strategy to try and you know, develop new rules which favor it, and then to impose them on the rest of us. And of course, how we maneuver in this period, as you say, the U.S. is the largest market in the world, and how we maneuver in this is a quite a complex question, technical question. So we will need to apply our minds to that. I don't have an answer. I have some ideas, but I don't have an answer. But I think that we need a, I mean, we need at least to have a common analysis of what is going on and what they want. In fact, they're not secretive about what they want. They're really straightforward, you know, what they want, and they tell you, you know. So the question of what we want and how we should maneuver to get to where we want to, so that is a strategic and tactical question. On the question of international finance, again, yes, it's a big, finance is a big player. The finance in the services, you know, there are big constituents who push for certain agreements in the gap. So services, the gap itself, they were the big players. One of the biggest players was Wall Street bankers, who were the drivers for the creation of the gap, because it was mainly the financial services sector, number one, you know, in the hierarchy of the different services stakeholders. And they remain you know, a significant player, even in this last few years, pushing for increased market access in different markets in financial services. They're still number one in the world, so they are pushing for it. And so they're already there. Finance plays a role both directly in services, but indirectly in other agreements in the WTO. So, you know, you'll find it in a number of different places, not so clearly and explicitly as financial services. Labor standards, it's very complex, you know, because as I said, there's a big debate, and about, you know, we have been working with the trade unions from the WTO side. In South Africa, we coordinated a group called the NAMA 11, so those countries that were interested in industrial tariff negotiations, and we were, so we created a coalition, but we also coordinated with the trade unions from those countries. So trade unions from Brazil and India and Thailand and Philippines, Egypt, Venezuela and others who were part of the coalition, we also talked to them on a regular basis. On the question of whether, you know, we need to incorporate labor standards into WTO, into trade agreements, it's a very complex debate, you know. So we have sympathies on both sides. But, you know, how we come up on it, I don't know. I think we have to discuss. It's not so easy. But certainly in ILO, there is no answer there. Because the thing about ILO is everybody comes there. So business comes and trade unions and governments. And in most cases, they don't talk to each other at home. In our case, we do, I know, because our guys
are always together because we have at least a culture. Even if we fight, we talk and we discuss. But in most countries, you know, they don't have that. So when they come only, when they come to IO, then they talk to us. So the IO is not very strong as an institution. It's not very good at making rules. It takes a long time, and it, you know, it's not designed to create standards which mess everyone up. Because there's so much of internal wrangling within it, you know. So I won't look to the aisle for solutions, but clearly it is a light of, you know, for us to try to make advances, but don't put too much in it at the moment because of the nature of the institution. On immigration and migration, migration and the revenue from migration is number one in the world. It's bigger than FDI, you know, bigger than foreign investment, because the receipts that countries like Philippines and even like Pakistan, India, you know, Ethiopia, they get on their foreign workers, you know, it's extremely high. It's not necessarily a good thing because, you know, it's the fate of your people that are coming back. Of course, it helps to balance, it helps grow countries, and I've seen it in Ghana. If you're driving on a car, you know, you see these buildings going up, it's all these Americans, all these Ghanaians who went to the U.S. sending back money, you know, the buildings are going up. In many countries, that is the source of growth, you know. So I'm sure even the people who are here on the streets in South Africa are sending money back to build houses and all the things in their country. The impact on our own country and, you know, positive and negative, it's a big debate, you know, it's a big debate. It's a big debate. So there are many issues involved here. You know, of course, policing and economic issues, but there's also political questions, foreign policy questions. So it's a bigger discussion. Thank you.
And look, Ambassador, you know, we've really only touched the surface here, but we've got such a tight program. I think members, as you look at this, you can see that we work Friday afternoons for four, as we should, every second, or we try and find other ways, and there aren't any other ways. But just to thank you very much, Ambassador. I know that you're around, and maybe what we can do from time to time is squeeze a half an hour in here, a half an hour in there, you know what I mean, as time allows. So on a Wednesday when there's nothing to pass, for example, a decision, we say, no, let's meet anyway, 8:30 to 9:30, you know, and have a session. So that we find creative ways of finding space here to try and accommodate the challenges members have with transport. And I'll put it that way. Thank you very much, Ambassador.
I just want to ask the Ambassador whether the paper he delivered at UJ...
I'm going to come to that, yeah. You know, the Ambassador has actually put almost everything on his website. And Ambassador, if I can just check with you, is that website available to all of us? Could you give it to us, please? And then we'll give it to us, and Mr. Hermans will make it available to everyone tomorrow morning. Okay, is that okay? Fine. Just a wee bit of housekeeping. I just need to be clear on the situation of these planes because I'm finalising this program now. Mr. Dr. Liyenge, you mentioned the Eastern Cape. What time is that plane on a Friday, the last plane at about midday, or whatever? You go to Johannesburg to get there. I think that's the issue. Is that the issue?
Yeah, that'd be
it. You go to Johannesburg to get to Umtata. Right, what time are you going to leave here to get to Umtata on that last plane?
I must take the 10-hour flight from here.
Right.
It takes 4 hours to
go. Hop up. That means at the very latest, you've got to be at the airport at 12:20.
Yes.
At the latest. Right, just so that I have some idea on the matter. Right. And I think, yes.
I had to leave to get my plane.
Now I'm asking everyone, I haven't forgotten you, Dean, please. I'm just trying to do the right thing. You were sitting over there.
I migrated.
And you're now losing your lunch. What is your situation? You're going to take it in, am I right? No, sorry. Okay, look, the Eastern Cape.
Is it the same situation?